busy travel time for reasons to believe this fall. Usually the fall and spring are, but I can't think of a fall that's been as busy as this past fall. And I really appreciate you sharing that thing about the book table, because we have to keep reminding our chapters all across the country that when it comes to the book table, you want to double or quadruple staff the book table. You know, there's no way one guy can manage it. And, you know, that's where all the action takes place, where people come up and ask you questions. You know, they're not there just to buy books. They want to find out about their relationship with the Lord and all these science faith issues that came up. And what we're always trying to do with our chapters is say, you need more people than you think you need just to process the books and the money. You weren't able to write everything down. And they all come at once. But you also need that many people, again, to be available to field questions that people have. And, you know, that's the benefit of having a chapter full of people that are trained to answer those kinds of questions. So it's good that you're at the table and answer those questions. It's too bad you're so busy selling the books that you couldn't get to those questions. But next time, we'll get three other people to join the table with you. And I just say that as a plug to the class, because it's a lot of fun hanging out at those book tables. And, you know, what I have to keep reminding our chapter people, too, is that when I'm speaking in front of an audience, guess who comes up to talk to me afterwards? It's the committed Christians and the committed atheists. The fence-sitters go to the back. They're not about to push their way through all these aggressive people. The shy ones, the ones that are sitting on the fence, they'll talk to ushers, they'll talk to people at the book table. They're not going to go to the front. So personally, I really count on people being at that book table to do the real heart of the ministry. I don't get to see a lot of action up front. I get to see a lot of arguments and fights, but that kind of action. But, you know, as far as leading people to Christ, that's what happens at the back more than anything else. Well, you know, it's fun, too, when I travel around the country to meet ex-members of the class. I met over half a dozen of them when I was in Chicago. You know, people that were regular members of this class, and now they're in Chicago, and it was a thrill for me to see that they are now members of the Chicago chapter. And I know one couple that you probably met and remember, because they were here just a few weeks ago, was Roger and Barbara Schwind. They're really active in the Chicago chapter. They brought their daughter Karen along. Got to see the latest addition to that family, and they're all involved. It's really fun. And I also think it was a real blessing is that, you know, we do special events for our chapter members, but also for our key donors in the area. And the thing that I didn't really realize is how many of our key donors are children. I mean, people 9, 10, 11 years old that are, you know, giving out of their allowance, out of their job. There's one boy, he's 10 years old. He's got this job going around the neighborhood doing things, and, you know, he gives his money to Reasons to Believe, and he's thrilled to do it. He's reading the material. He's obviously going to be a future apologist. You can just tell. He's really into it. But it's amazing, too, how these kids that are so dedicated to the ministry, both financially in terms of trying to get equipped, really have a way of ministering to the adults. You know, it's really humbling when you've got, say, four boys between the age of 9 and 11 who are so motivated to study this stuff. It just kind of gets everybody else really excited. So that was really fun. And I did two events at, well, it was at Crosswinds Church, which is a church kind of in north of between Wheaton and Chicago. And Wheaton's a suburb of Chicago. And it met in a movie theater. And I'm seeing this more and more, that churches are meeting in movie theaters, partly because the schools charge such outrageous rent. I mean, that's kind of the thing. You want to start a new church, you meet in a school, but a lot of schools really charge pretty hefty fees. And so now churches are going to movie theaters, and what you do is you go there at a time when they're not showing movies, like at 8 o'clock on Sunday morning. That's not a, you know, popular time for movies, so the movie theaters just see this as just some little extra income, and they get people coming to the theater that otherwise wouldn't come. And I think I noticed that works really well is that as the church grows, you just expand into other theaters. So, you know, because I was in a place where they had 18 theaters, and so each theater holds about 300, but when it gets into 500 or 600, they just close circuit TV into the next adjoining theater, and you just keep picking up theaters as you go. One I did in Canada, it was broadcast into three theaters as I spoke, and worked well. Although one thing that does concern me about these theater churches is the acoustics is so good you get blasted by the sound system. So I've learned the hard way, do not sit in the first 10 rows. You've got to sit way at the back. Otherwise, he'll be a little bit deaf when you have to get up there to speak. Pardon me? Well, there is a lot of popcorn there. I mean, that's one thing where, see, the theaters give these churches a really good deal. But it's because people can take all this food and drink into the church with them. Now, it's not like our church. I mean, you can bring popcorn and drink, and you can mess up all over the place, and nobody cares. So, yeah, so it's probably Diet Coke and popcorn as their communion. But as I was speaking, virtually everybody had a bucket of popcorn, and they were drinking their sodas. And so it's different. But I think it's good, too, because non-Christians really do feel comfortable in that kind of an atmosphere. We get a lot of non-Christians come to that event. And as some of you know, we're going to be going back to Chicago in February to do a major creation conference. Willow Creek Community Church is going to sponsor us to do that. If you haven't heard of Willow Creek, it's one of these mega churches, 40,000 members and growing. And they had me speak this time at their Wheaton branch. It's now become a denomination. It's no longer just South Barrington. They got churches all over the Chicago area. But I had a really good time meeting with the evangelism team of the Willow Creek denomination. There were six pastors they have working in the ministry of evangelism. And, they just want to learn about the experiences that we've had out here in the L.A. area over the past 30 years. We just had a fun time sharing with them. And I was surprised. The church, as big as they are and as evangelistic as they are, there's a lot of things they just aren't doing in the way of going out into the community and sharing their faith. So we had a good time talking with them about things we can do in February. And they're going to be opening up events for us. Now, this is our chapter, not so much Willow Creek, but our chapter there is opening up Fermi Labs. That's kind of a particle physics lab, places where they're making things or trying to make things like the God particle. 10,000 scientists and engineers work at that place. So looks like Buzz and I are going to get to speak there. And Argonne Labs, which is kind of atomic spectroscopy and molecular spectroscopy, also 10,000 scientists and engineers, doors opening up there. Lucent Technologies, that's private, that's not government. That's kind of the research arm of ITT. And we're all going to be speaking there. Ken Samples, Fuzz, and myself will be speaking at Lucent. Thanks to the fact that so many of the Lucent scientists are actually members of the Chicago chapter. In fact, two of the leaders of the group work at Lucent Technology as scientists. And also a member of our chapter is a cosmologist from Fermi Lab and several physics graduate students at the University of Chicago. So it looks like we'll get into the University of Chicago. We also had faculty from Trinity University and Seminary show up. And the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association is going to have us do some outreach training for a group of pastors while we're out there in February. I'm going to be gone at least one Sunday in February. I can tell you that much right now. Maybe two. We'll see how it goes. But it's just, the chapter is really active, really making things happen there. It's just a real thrill to watch all that that going on. And I also did a TV interview at something called Total Living Network. As we were driving up there, it says, wouldn't you rather have a partial living network? But Total Living Network. It's a national television Christian network. And I was interviewed by Jerry Rose. And, it's always fun when you go on these things where they've never heard of Reasons to Believe. They've never heard of me or looked at any of my books or anything. And what's the first question they ask when they find out I'm an astronomer? Well, tell me, Dr. Ross, what's all the scientific evidence against the Big Bang? And so you kind of have to back up a little bit and say, no, wait a minute. The Big Bang is not anti-Christian. This is something we should be thrilled about. Bible authors talked about it thousands of years before Albert Einstein came along. But what happens when you do that is the host really starts to get excited about a new tack on evangelism and outreach. And that's exactly what happened with Jerry Rose. And he's real eager to have us come back and do more interviews. So that's kind of what I was doing for the past several days. I've only been back a little bit. I'm thrilled to be back here for a few weeks now to talk about our study in the book of Job. Question?
Yeah, I had a question. In one of your books, it says there can't be an infinite amount of stars in an infinite universe, because then there would always be daylight on Earth.
But right.
An infinite amount of stars being an infinite amount away, wouldn't it take an infinite amount of time for the light to reach the Earth?
Okay, this is called Olber's paradox, which was the first clue that scientists had that we do not live in an infinite universe. And this is significant. I write about this in my first book, The Fingerprint of God, how, you know, there was this mindset that we live in an infinite universe, it's infinitely large and infinitely old. And that being the case, they would argue we don't need God because we would have an infinite number of possibilities for physics to, permutate different aspects, and one of them would be such that life would be possible. That was the kind of the thinking that was going on, 300 years ago, until Olbers came along in the 1800s and said the universe can't be infinite. Here's why: if the universe was infinite, then the night sky would be as bright as the daytime sky. And the principle is simply this: if all you do is assume that the stars are very roughly evenly distributed throughout the universe, then that means that when you move from, say, a distance of 5 light years out to a distance of 10 light years, you pick up 8 times as many stars. And even though the light, it becomes 1/4 as bright, when you double the distance, you've got 8 times as many stars, so that means you double the light every time you double the distance. And so if the universe is infinitely large, that means you're going to have infinite light in nighttime as well as daytime. In fact, the sky will be brighter than the sun itself. And therefore, we can't live in an infinite universe. Although there are those who have been saying, well, what if the stars are moving away from one another? If the stars are expanding, then they thought they could get around Olber's paradox. It turns out, if the universe is expanding, then that means there's a beginning in finite time. The universe can't be infinitely old. So, in some respect, the universe must be finite, and if it's finite, we really are looking at something beyond the physics itself to explain why the universe, in some places of the universe, has the properties that make life possible. So, that all goes back to 1836. That was kind of the beginning of physicists and astronomers realizing that naturalism is not going to explain why life exists in the universe. We need some kind of supernatural creator to explain why it's here. And, of course, now we know so much more. Yeah.
But that depends on the density of the stars. If you're talking about the uniform density, suppose there were an infinite amount of stars way out in infinity, above the observable universe. In other words, not just linear uniformly. You could have an infinite amount of stars at infinity, and it would take an infinite amount of time.
I'll tell you what, Bernard, I'm going to refer you to The Fingerprint of God, because I actually cover all of that in The Fingerprint of God. What was happening in the 1800s, however, is you got astronomers like John Herschel who did star counts. Simply looked through a really big, he had the biggest telescope in the world at the time, a 72-inch telescope, and he made these observations, deep observations, and counted the stars at certain distances. And that's where he recognized that, you know, to a rough approximation, we are looking at stars, at least in the observable universe, where they're roughly evenly distributed. So we don't see a falling density of stars as you go farther and farther away. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The farther away you look, the denser the stars become. Up close, they're not that dense, but as you look far away, they become denser and denser. But that's simply because the universe is finite in age. With an expanding universe, if you look back in time as you look far away, you're looking at a younger universe where the universe is smaller in size and therefore the stars are closer together. So it actually works the opposite direction of what the atheists were hoping for. Anyway, details are in The Fingerprint of God. Which does remind me, I was going to share with you one scientific discovery, which is kind of our habit in this class, start things off with a brand new scientific discovery and move on from there into our study of the book of Job. This one's in the latest issue of Science Magazine, and they don't really talk about design in the article, but they talk about a lot of other things that points to design. And what we're doing at Reasons to Believe is looking at the human species in particular and realizing there's certain attributes of human beings that really do not find utility until the 20th century. It's like God had created human beings in advance to survive and function well in a high technology, high affluent society. And so there's a lot of things that we can do that really had no value when God created us in the Garden of Eden. I mean, when you're only a small population with little technology, what's going to really help you to survive and to provide well for your family is not the capacity to type 100 words per minute. Okay, but being able to type 100 words per minute does have utility today. And also helps us to enjoy music. We otherwise wouldn't be able to enjoy and apply that to piano playing. Or just think of some of the mathematics that we do. The mathematics we're capable of doing is because of the way our brain lobes are structured. But consider this, for 50,000 years, those brain lobe structures really had no utility. It wasn't until the latter half of the 20th century that we really began to exploit that capability of our brain to do that kind of thing. When you're hunting woolly mammoths, that kind of brain structure really doesn't factor into your capacity to hunt woolly mammoths with higher efficiency. And so there's certain over-endowments that we human beings have that cannot be explained by an evolutionary pathline. I mean, why would evolution give us the capacity to do things that would have no utility for 50,000 years and suddenly have high utility? You can't claim we got that from species of life that existed before us, or that somehow our genes changed over those tens of thousands of years. And incidentally, I won't go into this, but they've now recovered DNA from people who've been dead 40,000 years, and we cannot see significant genetic drift. So it looks like there's been very little change in the DNA of human beings with respect to time. And therefore, the evolutionists are left without any answer for why we have these amazing capabilities, which we did not exploit for the first 50,000 years of our existence. We're really only exploiting them for the past 50 years. But it makes perfect sense from the standpoint of a creator who knew in advance that Adam and Eve and their descendants would eventually get to the point where these kinds of capabilities would be important for their capacity to function in a high technology, high affluence of civilization. Well, here's a couple more. This has got nothing to do with biology per se. It's a discovery made by three material scientists who have noted that they've just discovered a new class of materials, and these are called, let me get the name right here, polysilicon germanium substances. You say, what are those? Well, those are special substances which allows us to build these microprocessor sensors that are able to go inside the human body, able to go inside high temperature environments, which is critical for certain metallurgy applications. And the sensor is able to work in such a way, and then it can be immediately processed by adjoining microelectronics that's not damaged by the conditions inside the human body or damaged by the high temperature or high pressure conditions. And reading this article, what I realize is that God has in advance designed germanium, gave it the right electron features, gave it the right nuclear ground state energy levels such that it could be used in combination with polysilicon to make these amazing devices. Now the question I asked myself in reading this article, would the design of this germanium, its properties, have utility outside of advanced sensor microelectronics? Frankly, maybe there are some, but I just can't think of any. Germanium is not an element that's used in biological systems. And I don't see germanium playing a critical role in any of the design features of the universe or the Earth that would make life possible on our planet. But it does clearly, I mean, germanium has been exploited for over 100 years in microelectronics. But what this article points out, there really is no other way to make these microsensors work without the microsensors being damaged, unless we had this material available. So maybe some of you are more clever than I am, but I'm trying to think, you know, what are some other applications? But one of the things that kind of hit me is maybe God designed this in advance with the idea that at the 21st century, and by the way, it's only been in the past 6 months that these devices have been successfully exploited. First in medical technology, but now they're thinking of using these things for high temperature, high radiation, high pressure conditions, such as we find in outer space. There was a hand over here somewhere? Okay, yes. Okay, I didn't know that. I just checked my book on the elements that I have at my office, which lists which elements are used biologically and what amounts and what levels they would have of toxicity. Germanium wasn't listed at all. So, yeah, it's a very small level. But anyway, just a suggestion that maybe there's things that God has designed not just in the human body to sustain technology, but actually in the chemistry and the physics of the different elements we see in the atomic chart. It's in the latest issue of Science if you want to check that out. We've been going through Job 38 for quite some time. It's a passage that reflects on all six creation days we see in Genesis 1. And we spent some time looking at the content of Job 38 as it pertains to the six creation days and how it gives us understanding of a lot of the things that Christians and non-Christians dispute in terms of their interpretation of Genesis 1. And kind of a theme of this class is, before you get into a big fight over what Genesis 1 is saying about creation, or when you run into some agnostic who says, I can't believe the Bible because it's talking about things that are scientifically absurd, and you know Genesis 1 is usually one of the places they go. Well, before we get into any discussion or dialogue here, let's see what Job 38 has to say. Let's see what Psalm 104 has to say and Proverbs 8, because those are three additional chapters in the Bible, as well as Genesis chapter 2 that you can go to that will comment on the content of the six creation days. And there's been a lot of dispute on what the text is saying about those six creation days, but Job 38 is one place we can go to clarify that. And we spent some time doing that. What we're doing now is going through Job 38 and realizing this is the beginning of God's creation tests. Now, he's got these five scientists here. You know, he's got Elihu and Job and the three that have been attacking Job's theology and Elihu's theology. And you know, they're all talking about things in the record of nature and how they can use that to determine what God's attributes are and God's plan of salvation. Book of Job is famous for that very thing. But at the end of it all, God comes in and says, okay, you five guys think you're so smart about science, I got some questions for you. And Job 38 is the beginning of those questions, and I've counted 59 questions that God asks to these five early scientists. And you know, one question I posed to you was, well, how many of these 59 questions were the five scientists able to answer? The answer is zero. So how many should they have been able to answer? I would argue they should have been able to answer 59. So what kind of score did they get in the test? Well, it's an F minus as far as I'm concerned. And you say, well, how could they possibly know all this stuff? Well, if you go back to Genesis 1, verses 28 to 30, after the six creation days, what God does is he addresses Adam and Eve directly and says, these are your responsibilities. And to summarize it, God puts Adam and Eve and their descendants in charge of the planet to manage the resources of the whole planet for the benefit of all life. And which is why he says, I want you to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. In other words, first thing you need to do is occupy the planet in sufficient numbers that you can figure out what the resources of the planet are. take an inventory, and then come up with a wise plan to manage that inventory for the benefit of all life. And he closes it off by saying, pay particular attention to the green plants. That's the base of the food chain. The green plants aren't taken care of, nobody gets to eat. And when you look at these 59 questions, these are questions you would like to be able to answer in order to fulfill the responsibility of Genesis 1, 28 to 30, which leads me to speculate that if Adam and Eve and their descendants had not rebelled against the authority of God, God would have worked with them so they would have gained the instruction they need that they can answer all these questions and thereby be able to effectively manage the resources of the whole planet for the benefit of all life. So I think one thing God's communicating to these five men and to all the readers of the book of Job is that sin really gets in the way of our capacity to advance our knowledge and understanding of the created realm so that we can fulfill God's mandate that he's placed upon us. But, you know, looking up through, yes, go ahead.
Do you think there's a difference, though, between the needs of a creator and the needs of an operator? For example, the guy who operates his ship doesn't need to know how it's built. He needs to know how to repair it. He needs to know how to keep it running. But he doesn't need to know the metallurgy that went into the shaft.
No, he doesn't. Somebody does, though, in order to build the thing.
Right.
So, right. And, you know, isn't that what's involved in terms of trying to manage the whole planet? Someone's got to take inventory to figure out what the resources are. Someone needs to understand how those resources can be applied, and someone actually needs to put it into use. And it needs to be fully integrated so we're not putting too many resources in one area and not enough in another. It takes a lot of wisdom, and that requires a good communication channel with God. Sin gets in the way. So, and you know, as someone who's worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, I think you understand that a Christian worldview really does help to do more efficient research. You know, I've noticed that at Caltech when I was working, it was the Christian astronomers who avoided going down what I would call blind alleys of research, where you expend a lot of effort going down something that from a Christian worldview perspective you could already determine will not be productive. So you can save a lot of time, a lot of effort, by having that kind of right worldview perspective. And, you know, if, a certain freedom from sin also helps to avoid wasting time on non-productive areas. And it's not so much that you're wasting time. You know, as I saw at Caltech, people would argue and say, well, no, this isn't totally non-productive. But the question is it as productive as something else that you could be doing? And often in research, if you focus your efforts on an area that's has a high probability of being productive in a short period of time, that success can help you save time in an area where you'd be less productive than you went after it in the first place. But I think the publisher parish atmosphere that works in a research realm sometimes encourages people to go up these kinds of alleys. Yeah, anything I can publish, exactly. Okay. But, you know, looking at this, what we noted in past Sundays is that, you know, we've come a long ways since Job and Elihu and their three friends. It's been 3,500 years. A lot of research has been done. And surely we can do better on this test than Job, Elihu, and their three friends. Well, we can do better. We can answer 9 of the 59 questions. But, you know, those of you who are school teachers would realize 9 of the 59 on a test is still an F minus. So we're still not doing that well. Unless you're great on a curve. There you go. But I think as you read through Job 38 to 41, one message comes through loud and clear. We're not as smart as we think we are. And, you know, we're not as well equipped to study the record of nature as we think we are. We really do need God's help. And it also impresses us just how wonderful and majestic and intelligent and knowledgeable our Creator is. And shouldn't he be the first one we go to when we got these kinds of questions? So I think that comes across loud and clear, the fact that we're still not doing well. But one of the things that I mentioned last Sunday, or the Sunday I was with you, is that there's something interesting about the 9 questions we can answer. Every one of those 9 questions provides us with a powerful apologetic tool to persuade people that this book indeed is written by a supernatural transcendent being that it is error-free, that this is the one holy book that accurately predicts future scientific discoveries. So there's a lot within Job 38 where we can come up with answers that provides us with new tools to reach out for people and show them that there is a creator that cares for them, that loves them, is all-powerful, all-wise, and has a plan of salvation, and has written a book filled with words that we can trust. And I think we got through three of these, or at least two. Verse 8, the first part of verse 8 in Job 38 reads, "Who can shut up the sea behind doors?" And I made the point that this confirms a key prediction made in Genesis 1 that is found in no extra biblical creation account. You know, when I was 10 years old, I read a book on creation myths and basically exposed me to about 200 creation stories in the different cultures of the world. But this book in Genesis 1, the Bible, is really the only book that makes the point that planet Earth started off where we had this ocean that covered the whole planet, and then God worked to disturb the planet in such a way that then it got changed to being, instead of just one universal ocean covering the whole surface, to where you got continental land masses coexisting with oceans, and how this is a critical requirement for life. It's mentioned in several creation accounts in the Bible, and in Job 38 in particular rather explicitly states from verses 8, actually starts in verse 6 and runs through to verse 9, that God actually prepared the planet for advanced life by transforming the planet from a universal ocean and building these doors and holding the sea back behind these doors. So this is a prediction that was made. I remember when I went to graduate school, my professors, I took a course in geophysics, and one of that professors said, "Well, we all know that the planet started off with just these continental land masses, and it was only really in the last 10 years that geophysicists have recognized that that model is incorrect, that the continents have always been here. We now know that, no, the planet really did start off with a universal ocean, and that it took plate tectonics operating for billions of years to transform our planet from a universal ocean to where we have 29% continental land masses today. By the way, the continents are still growing. So in the future, it'll be 30% and 31%, but it's growing very, very slowly. And then the astronomers can actually determine now exactly how the planet changed from 100% oceans to 3% oceans, then it grew quickly to 21% oceans, then slowly up to the current 29%. Yes. No, I'm not saying that. Matter of fact, in our worship service this morning, we were studying Psalm 136. If you read verse 6, it talks about God spreading out the land masses. Interesting phrase. It's probably the most explicit statement you'll find in the Bible on a continental drift. But what Job 38 is simply talking about is how the planet did start off as universal water, and then God began to form these land masses that popped up above the surface of the waters. That's probably happened several times. I mean, what we can trace in some detail is the movement of the continental land masses over the last quarter of a billion years. And so starting a quarter of a billion years ago, there was this single continent surrounded by this ocean. Then the continent broke up and has formed these seven continents we see today. Now the reason we can't trace things any earlier than 250 million years is 251 million years ago, the planet received some kind of extraterrestrial collision event, a really big one, that resulted in a whole, you know, literally thousands of volcanoes all over Siberia erupting. And those Siberian volcanoes spewed out lava that was able to pave the entire surface of the planet 20 feet deep. So this is a massive event, and it literally reshaped the whole surface of the Earth, and that's why we can't trace things any earlier than 250 million years ago. Although we do know that there's certain land masses that have been around a long time, like Greenland. Greenland's been around for about 3.85 billion years, but we don't know its path of movement over the surface of the Earth. So the movement can only be traced over the past 250 million. But most geophysicists believe that what's been happening over the last 4 billion years is that these land masses would form, separate, come together, separate, come together in some undefined manner. Now, keep in mind, it's only been above 20% of the surface area of planet Earth for about the last 1 billion years, last 750 million. Previous to that, we're looking at a much smaller part of the planet. In fact, in the first, like say, from 3.8 billion to about 2.5 billion years ago, you're simply looking at small islands. So it's like volcanic eruptions would create islands like Hawaii in a few places on the planet, but if you added up all those islands, it only comes to, you know, 1, 2, or 3%. And it's only after that that you actually see really large islands forming and then plate tectonics operating so that you get continents, not just islands. So the first land masses were simply volcanic islands. And it took a couple of billion years for plate tectonic activity to convert the ocean basalt layers into silicate in sufficient quantity that the silicate could float above the basalt and make continental land masses. That took a long time. Now, interestingly, when you go to Genesis chapter 1, where does it put that event? On creation day 3. Now, from what we know about geophysics, we realize creation day 3 does mark that time of the most rapid continental landmass growth. That's when it went from about 3% up to about 21% in a fairly rapid period of time. Say, what's rapid? Oh, about 600 million years. That's rapid to a geophysicist. But it's smack right in the middle of the history of life on planet Earth, and creation day 3 is smack in the middle of what God was doing in the 6 creation days. So this is a remarkable set of discoveries that enables us to show that there's tremendous veracity and predictability in Genesis chapter 1. It's got the time right, it's got the details right, and then we have these other passages like Job 38 and Psalm 104, which actually describe in a little more detail what God was doing with these continental land masses. So this is a tool we can use to persuade people, you know, this book is different from all the other holy books. It predicts in tremendous detail. Yes. Now, okay, at the very beginning, you have planet Earth in a molten state. And then it gradually cools to the point where you get a thin crust around the Earth that solidifies into rock. But the planet is much smoother than it is today, because plate tectonics really hasn't operated for very long. And then the planet is accumulating a huge quantity of comets from outer space. Also, there's indigenous water to planet Earth. And so, you know, you go back those billions of years, you're actually looking at a little higher quantity of water than what we have today. And with the planet being so smooth after its initial solidification from a molten state, that water is going to cover the whole surface of the Earth. Now, thereafter, what's happening is that this crust of the Earth, which is basically 100% basalt, begins to transform into basalt and silicates. And the silicates are lighter than the basalt, so the silicates form, they'll accumulate on top of the basalt, and if you wait long enough, the accumulation grows to a point where it breaks the surface of the water. So that's the primary means for growing continents. A secondary means is volcanic islands. But you look on the planet today, volcanic islands make up just the tiniest fraction of a percent of the total land area. The predominant feature would be the plate tectonics, which is building up these silicates. And that happens because you get these internal eddies inside the mantle of the Earth with basalt plates attached to them. And then between the eddy circulations, you'll get cracks where subduction can take place. And because of the way God designed the Earth, you get just the right chemistry to make transform that basalt into silicates. I'll tell you what's really interesting is that it takes talc to make it all work. And, you know, the oceans are just the right depth at just the right temperature so that it's about 4 miles deep that you need it, 4 or 5 miles deep. And with that depth of water and the temperature of the water, you can get talc forming at the junction of two tectonic plates. And that talc is slippery, which allows one plate to slide under the other and pushes one plate above the other and speeds up the production of basalts into silicates. Otherwise, we'd still be living on a water world today. Next time you have your Thanksgiving dinner, that's coming up in a little while, right? Maybe you can spend a moment and thank God for the talc and thank God for the way he designed the planet so that there'd be talc so that these things can slip so that we can be here in only 3.8 billion years after the first life forms, rather than taking 10 billion years, which by the time the sun would incinerate the planet. So, talc is good. All right. Yes. There is a Pangaea, but when they talk about this Pangaea, the supercontinent that broke up into 7 continents, we're only talking the last 250 million years. Because of the big event at the Permian catastrophe 251 million years ago, we cannot trace the movements of continental land masses before that. We know Greenland's been around a long time, but we have no idea where Greenland was previous to 250 million years ago. Okay. You can read about this, I think we have it over there in the table, a book called Rare Earth. And it's written by an agnostic astronomer and an atheist paleontologist. But a good chunk of the book is devoted to this miracle, they actually use that word, of plate tectonics, which allows a planet to form where you've got continents and oceans. In fact, they conclude the book by saying they believe that Earth may be the only planet in the entire universe that has this structure where you've got large oceans separated by large continents. And so they spend a good chunk of the book describing how that took place, and we actually know enough about the physics. So this is the reason why this is one of the few questions in Job 38 that we can answer. Research has been done to help us understand exactly how a planet transformed from a universal ocean to the continents we have today. And although we can't trace the movements any earlier than 250 million years ago, we can trace with rather great precision the growth of the continental land masses and islands. So you'll see a graph in the book, for example, which shows you the growth of land above sea level starting 3.8 billion years ago and then ending at the present year. They even predict where it's going to go in the future. And it's all based on understanding of the uranium and thorium content of the interior of the Earth and what that would predict for us in terms of the efficiency with which basalt will be converted to silicates. They have a whole piece there on the talc problem and how that enables a higher efficiency or rate of growth of the continental land masses and the volcanic eruptions. So just knowing the physics of the interior of the Earth and the composition of the interior of the Earth allows geophysicists to predict with rather high precision exactly how the landmass percentage went from zero up to its present 29% and what's going to happen in the future. Yes?
Is an earthquake evidence of too little talc, where there's a sudden movement instead of a slower slipping?
Okay, the only place where you get significant talc formation which helps things slip is in these underwater subduction zones. Because it takes high density, fairly low temperature water to make the talc in any great quantities. So,
it sounds like
It's like baby powder, exactly. Yeah, you know how slippery that is. Okay. And so, but it can only form when you get two plates coming together where you get a lot of ocean water on top. And that will lead to the talc production, which allows these things to slip under. But we've got other places where they come together where the talc isn't there in any great quantities, and that's where you get rather significant earthquakes. And then you're aware that the earthquakes take place at different depths. Well, at one depth you might have the talc there, the other depths you won't. So even at the subduction zones where you got the water, you can still get massive earthquakes. Okay, but hey, if it wasn't for that talc, things would be a lot more jittery than they are right now. So, in fact, years ago I wrote an article on how, and I think it's in Facts and Faith magazine, how a talc production is just as big of a problem not having slippery enough. And that has to do with the silicate production. The silicate production is maximized where you got the talc production fine-tuned. Too little talc, you won't get enough silicate production. Too much talc, you won't get it either. It's got to be just right. And when you look at planet Earth, that's something you see in rare Earth. We're seeing the silicate production happening at the maximum rate the laws of physics would permit. So the planet is ideally designed to make this happen at a highly rapid rate. You know, that's the thing that's amazing. This planet gets prepared for human life in only 3.8 billion years after the formation of the first life form. It's incredibly speedy. And that book will help you appreciate just how fast that is. But given the fact that if God took any more time than 3.8 billion years, there'd be no way you could have human beings with high civilization, high technology. Okay, let me quickly move on to number two. I didn't mean to get bogged down in number one like that, but we did cover a lot of material that we didn't get to cover when we covered that, so that's good. But number two is review. This is the part about the clouds. Where it says that God wrapped the ocean in thick darkness. That's verse 9, second half of verse 9. And how this confirms a critical prediction and interpretation of Genesis 1. And I say that because I remember getting a lot of abuse in talking about Genesis 1 when I was at the University of Toronto to my non-Christian fellow students and professors. And they just said this text is just absurd, the way it talks about light being created in the beginning. Light being created in creation day one, the sun not showing up till the fourth day. But Job 38 really clarifies that for us. It tells us that Genesis 1 is not talking about the creation of light, but the appearance of light for the first time at the surface of the waters. Job 38 verse 9 tells us that God wrapped this ocean that covered the whole surface of planet Earth in thick darkness and did it with clouds. It's the clouds that were dark. It wasn't the lack of light, it's the fact that the clouds were dark, and how God transformed the Earth's atmosphere from opaque to translucent. And again, when I was at the University of Toronto, there were astronomers saying, this is not the condition of the primordial Earth. Now we know it is, that indeed the primordial Earth did start off with opaque clouds. But I can remember a time 30 years ago when astronomers were saying that was not the case. But now we've made discoveries to establish that if this is indeed the case, so I've often used this as a piece of evidence where the Bible predicted a scientific discovery that went against the grain. Here were scientists saying the opposite, but the Bible made a comment here that advancing astronomical research proved to be correct and also establishes an interpretation of Genesis 1 that gets us out of deep apologetic trouble. And, this isn't a trivial point. As I read most of the commentaries in Genesis 1, most of them are still claiming that God created light on creation day 1 and did not create the sun, the moon, and the stars until creation day 4. And with that position, you'll never convert an astronomer to the Christian faith because they know that's utterly absurd. Matter of fact, you don't have to be an astronomer. All you got to do is read the text and say, doesn't it say the plants were created on the third day and the sun doesn't show up till day 4? Don't we have a problem? What's going to keep those plants warm? Sunlight and sun heat are a good thing. You can calculate what the temperature of our planet would be without the sun being there. It would be 3 degrees above absolute zero. So, yes? Okay. So, But number three and number four, boy, I'm running out of time here. But number three, have you journeyed to the springs of the sea? This is verse 16, first part of verse 16. Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea? I'll just make three quick statements here. Yes. I did? All right. Okay, that's where I ended? All right. Okay, let's move on to number four, which is verse 19, second half. Where does darkness reside? You know, and I wrote this one down as one. By the way, when I first started doing this study of questions we can answer, this was not on my list. It's on my list today. Astronomers have finally figured out where darkness resides. They've also figured out that darkness is a dominant feature of the universe. 99.5% of the stuff of the universe is dark. Only 0.5% is stuff that we can see through our telescope, through optical light. And only a few weeks ago, astronomers figured out the location of the darkness and what makes up the darkness. Okay, the darkness has three components. One component is what we call dark ordinary matter. And so that's stuff made up of protons and neutrons that's not in a big enough coagulation that it emits any light. So it's dark. I remember as a graduate student in astronomy, there was this guy called James Peebles at Princeton University. And he was trying to figure out how the light stuff that we see in the universe really doesn't explain the dynamics of the universe. And so he postulated that the universe was 0.5% stars and galaxies and 99.5% pebbles, which allowed all the other astronomers to make the joke that the universe is peebled with pebbles, or another joke that it was pebbled with peebles. But the whole idea of appealing to pebbles are if they're pebbles, there's no way you're going to be able to see them. And yet, this dark stuff is what we need to explain the dynamics of the universe that we observe. Well, we now know that the pebbles can't possibly make up 99.5% of the universe. At best, they make up about 4% of the universe. So the stars and galaxies that we observe, that's 0.5%. Ordinary dark matter makes up 4%. And ordinary dark matter could be things like a planet or anything smaller than a planet. You know, Jupiter has some light from it. Even without the sunlight, it would glow with a little bit of light, but it'd be very feeble. It's only a few degrees above absolute zero. But once you get something a little farther away than Jupiter of that size, there's no way you're going to see it by its light. It will be dark. And indeed, the universe contains a lot of things like the planet Jupiter and a lot smaller and probably lots of pebbles. So James Peebles, I think, is right. There are a lot of pebbles in the universe. And that's dark stuff, and we know where that resides now. Basically, the pebbles and stuff all the way up to the size of planets resides in the same place as the stars do, very roughly. So when you look at a galaxy and you see all the stars that are there and the glowing gas and the glowing dust, the dark stuff follows the same pattern as the light stuff. No, that's not true. We found another pile of dark stuff, okay? And this is the new discovery. Astronomers have known for some time that the universe is about 23% exotic dark matter. Now, these aren't pebbles. These aren't things like small planets that are far away where we can't see them. This would be fundamental particles that have a property that they do not interact well with photons or with light. And therefore, they're not going to emit any light. They will be dark. They'll be totally dark. One exotic mass particle that we're well aware of is a neutrino. Neutrinos are very tiny particles, and they're whizzing around the universe, and we know the universe has lots of them. And a neutrino interacts so poorly with ordinary matter that every day millions of them go through your body, and they don't hit a thing. Most, you know, neutrinos can go through the entire planet Earth and don't hit a thing. And so here's our planet Earth, you know, being showered with these quadrillions of neutrinos. They fly right through. Their path is not diverted. They just go right through. They don't interact with a thing. And because of that that lack of interaction, they are dark. But it makes up five times as much of the universe as protons, neutrons, and electrons. Well, yeah, in fact, some of these detectors are rather exotic. Rather than pointing up like you do with ordinary telescopes, they point down. And they use the whole 8,000-mile stuff of the planet Earth to have at least one or two of those neutrinos interact so they can detect them. They're not totally non-interacting particles. In fact, they refer to them as WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. And so every once in a while, of these quadrillions of neutrinos flowing through the Earth, one of them will interact very weakly. And it's that extremely weak interaction that they try to pick up with these massive detectors inside mines. And so, most of them just go whizzing right through and don't do anything, but every once in a while they get lucky and they get a weak interaction. And because there's literally quintillions and quintillions of these things, you can get one or two that do interact. We're out of time. Okay, I'll tell you more about weakly interacting massive particles next week, and there's a new discovery. We now know exactly where this stuff resides. Yeah, I'll tell you real quick just to go home so you can thank God for it at Thanksgiving. What they've seen, they've now got new maps of galaxies, which shows that the stars follow these spiral patterns, and the ordinary dark matter also follows those patterns, but then there's this gigantic donut shape outside the galaxy. So outside our Milky Way galaxy, a long ways beyond our Milky Way galaxy, is this gigantic donut of exotic dark matter. And we now know that every galaxy has one of those. And the donuts are just the right size to stabilize the spiral structure of the galaxy. And if that spiral structure wasn't stable, we wouldn't be able to live here on planet Earth. So again, when you have your Thanksgiving dinner, you might want to take a moment out to thank God for that 23% for all those donuts. Yeah. Weekly interacting donuts. There you go. But hey, we'll talk a little bit about the donuts next week, and then the real big source of darkness, which is dark energy, and how that is positioned in exactly the right place to make life possible. So when God says, "Do you know where darkness resides?" Today, for the first time, we know it resides, but it's giving us literally the strongest evidence we have today for supernatural design. If you're to ask me as a scientist, where can we go to get the greatest scientific evidence for supernatural, superintelligent design? It's darkness. It's not in the light, it's in the darkness. Hopefully I'll give you some motivation and come back next week. Father in heaven, thank you that we live in a nation that takes a day out every year to thank you for your amazing provision. And Lord, I pray that you would give us much cause to meditate over all the blessings you poured upon us throughout this past year, but literally throughout the past 13.7 billion years, how you've made this such a bountiful planet in which we can live and enjoy life and experience the technology and the affluence that enables us to fulfill the commands that you've given to us. So as we give thanks this week, Lord, may we also look forward to that moment in the future when, with your help, we will fulfill the Great Commission and bring the good news of Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world, and then enter a new creation that will be even more bountiful than this one. Lord, may this give us great joy and peace and comfort and security. In Jesus' name, amen.